2. So he, Matt said my title, From Flapping Birds to Space Telescopes, and you're all sitting there going, what could those possibly have to do with one another? But there is a connection, and that's what I'm going to tell you about tonight, and that connection happens through mathematics. So we're going to journey from one to the other. But let me start in the easy part, the flapping birds, the origami. What is origami? And most people have a pretty good idea of what origami is because we all did it in school, elementary school. It's toys, flapping bird, blow-up bunny, cootie catcher. Everyone's done origami. It's folded paper. It's not very valuable, just simple things, entertainment. And it's been around for a really long time. The word is Japanese, and the art has been a decorative form in Japan for a very long time. This is a woodcut from 1797, and these women are playing with a little string of figures, and if you were to zoom in on one of those, it's this shape. This is the traditional Japanese crane, or tsuru. People have been folding that exact figure for over 200 years. Every Japanese person learns to fold that crane in kindergarten. And a little bit older, this is an image from 1734, and it shows several figures. Here's a crane, and a boat, and a little man, and a cube. So, even in 1734, this art was very well developed. The oldest known reference we have to origami is only in words. It's in 1680, there's a reference to this thing called orisue, which means a paper butterfly. And this is an image from an 1845 publication of Orisua. They're called the Ocho and Micho butterflies, male, female butterflies. Very simple, but recognizably folded paper. Now, most origami nowadays is made from a single uncut square. The Japanese term for that is Fusetsu Seihoke Ichimai Ori. And that, I practiced a long time to say that. But that restriction is actually quite modern. The old Japanese papers included cut things. So this is a pattern from 1797, where you take the paper and you slit it, and then you can fold this chain of connected cranes. And people are still folding the exact pattern today. These are works by a modern artist, Masao Okamura, using the ancient pattern. And you would think this folding-only restriction, especially one-piece no-cuts, that long ago people would have figured out everything that was possible to do, because that's such a tight restriction, no cuts. And so the art would be dead, static. And that would have been a pretty good description of the art up until about the middle of the 20th century. And we can blame it all on this man, Akira Yoshizawa. He was a Japanese. He took up the native art, and he began developing new figures. He developed hundreds, actually thousands, of new origami figures. These are a couple of his original designs. And his work inspired a renaissance in the world of origami. But even more important than the examples of the figures, he created a language. This system of arrows and dashed lines and dotted lines that had specific meaning that allowed origami artists to teach one another, to communicate with one another, to share their ideas, and to build off of what each other had done. And this language, as much as his examples, launched a new era of origami. An exponential growth, Moore's Law of origami, that has taken origami to someplace very different from toys and flapping birds, and has taken origami to something more like this. So this, too, is origami. One sheet, no cuts. But this, which is one of my designs, is not just a bird. It has lots of details. It's got leaves and pine cone leaves and a deer's head and a cuckoo. And it has the correct time twice a day. But it's still one sheet, no cuts. It's still origami. Modern origami is organic and natural. And you can put in soft, curved forms and little bits of detail like ears and horns and a beard. And if you look close at the feet, there are cloven hooves. And modern origami even lets us create things from a mathematician's imagination. Or perhaps a mathematician
person's nightmare.
Origami is not even restricted by topology. And so when people start seeing what modern origami is like, a question inevitably comes up. What changed? And I like to be very provocative, depending on my audience, and say what changed was that math came to origami. Origami artists began to use math. And many of my artistic origami friends say, well, that's not right. I'm not a mathematician. I don't use math. But in fact, they do, because origami artists began applying mathematical principles to the art. And that is what took the art to this new level. So what kind of math gets into origami? Quite a bit, in fact. Mathematicians ask and answer three types of questions: existence, complexity, algorithms. And that's simply asking, what is possible? How hard is it, if it's possible? And if you know that it's possible and you know how hard it is, what's the actual solution to a problem? And those types of questions, when applied to origami, tap into many branches of math. High school math, geometry, trig, more advanced math, calculus, differential geometry, graph theory, group theory, complexity. All the different branches of mathematics have their tendrils into origami. Why is that? Well, let's look at how we design an origami shape. Let's look at the plan for an origami figure. And that plan is encapsulated in a thing called a crease pattern. It's the blueprint. I'll show one in just a second. A crease pattern is a map for how to fold an origami shape. It's a listing of all the folds. And a simple question we can ask, and that people have asked, is what are the rules of crease patterns? If I draw a set of folds, is that valid origami? So I want to start by just talking about the rules of crease patterns. Now, what do I mean by a crease pattern? Well, if I wanted to fold this shape, tell you how to fold this shape, I'd say I need a fold here and a fold there. And you can see the folds go different ways. We'll call this fold a valley fold, and we'll indicate it by a dashed line, because it looks like a valley. We'll call this fold a mountain fold, and we'll indicate it by a solid line, because it looks like a mountain. All origami folds, no matter how complicated, even that cuckoo clock, are made up of nothing more than valley folds and mountain folds. But it's the number and the arrangement that makes all the difference. So this is an origami crease pattern. This is a plan for an origami figure that I'll show a little bit later. And it looks very complicated, and it's got different colors, but fundamentally it's nothing more than valley folds and mountain. So what are the properties of one of these folds? Can you draw any pattern of lines and know that it will fold into a piece of origami? Well, the answer is no. The pattern has to obey a set of rules. And you might think those rules are arcane, complex, a thick book that origami artists must memorize. But no, there's only four rules, and they're so simple, we're all going to learn them here, and you can all go out here and do origami. What are they?
What does that become when you fold it?
It's a surprise. I'll show it a little bit later. Here's the first rule. Very simple. Every origami crease pattern must be what's called two-colorable. Simply put, if you think of it as a map of countries, you only need two colors to color every region so that no two of the same color touch. So this is a bird, there's its crease pattern, and here's a two-coloring. And every flat origami pattern has to be two-colorable. If we look at the specifics of the mountains and valley folds, there's a law that describes what happens at any vertex, at any point, which is, if you count the number of mountains and you count the number of valleys, they have to differ by two. And you can verify this. So here's a pattern. I've got four mountains here and two valleys, so that's four minus two. And here I've got three valleys and one mountain, so that's three minus one. It always differs by two. If I instead look at the angles, I go to a point and I measure the angles and I number them in order, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, then it has to satisfy a very curious property, that if I take all of the odd-numbered angles, 1, 3, and 5, and I add them up, they must add up to a straight line. And all of the even-numbered angles must add up to a straight line. That's an interesting property, but every single vertex in the interior has to satisfy that. And you can imagine that might get a little tricky, because let's say I try to make it work for this vertex and I adjust this line's angle. Well, it's going to affect what happens at the next vertex. And the last rule, the number four, the one where all the trouble comes, deals with layer ordering. Conceptually, it's very simple. It just says no matter how you order the layers in a flat shape, the paper can't penetrate itself. So if I've got a fold next to a flat sheet, I can put the sheet below the fold or above it, but I can't put the sheet between the folds because then the paper would penetrate. And similarly, if I have two folds next to each other, they can be stacked or wrapped, but they can't alternate because, again, the paper would penetrate. And that's all there is to it. Those are the four rules of flat origami. If you satisfy those rules, your shape is guaranteed to fold flat. So that sounds pretty easy. Well, how easy is it? Is that a question?
What do you mean by overlaps here?
If this layer overlaps that layer, sits on top of, when you press it flat, if they are nearly in contact. So, four rules. How easy? Well, satisfying two-colorability turns out to be really easy. In fact, if all the vertices have an even number of lines, that gives you that property. Satisfying the mountain-valley difference, that turns out to be easy. Even alternate angles is easy. But finding an arrangement that satisfies the layer ordering, that turns out to be hard. How hard was only discovered or proven about 10 years ago. In 1996, two computer scientists, mathematicians, Marshall Byrne and Barry Hayes from Xerox, showed that a special type of logic problem called not all equal 3SAT, that's a logic problem, it could be encoded as a crease pattern, as a crease assignment problem, and vice versa. For any logic problem, there was an origami crease pattern equivalent to that problem, and if you knew the mountain valley assignment, it gave you the answer to the logic problem. Why was that significant? Because this particular logic problem is of a type called NP-complete, which in complexity theory means it's really hard. And so they proved that origami is hard. And also, NP-complete problems are the basis of cryptographic systems. And so origami, if you had an efficient way to solve any origami problem, you could solve many, many problems of great technological interest and become a millionaire. But this is whether NP-complete problems have an easy solution is one of the great unsolved problems in mathematics. There's a $1 million prize for the person who proves that this problem is either polynomial or proves that it isn't.
If I go back to the crane that you say we all learned early on,
yes.
Do I easily, in that case, verify this property four?
For the crane, we know that, so the crane, we know a crease assignment that works. And fortunately, not all origami problems turn out to be NP-complete. In fact, only very special problems have this special difficulty. So most of these problems, we are lucky that most origami problems turn out to be computationally tractable. And we can, in fact, find crease patterns and fold things, like what I've shown up front. Yeah?
I would imagine that the same crease pattern, if it is folded in different sequence, I mean, how do you distinguish between the same crease pattern of mountain and valley folds and the order in which those folds are made? Wouldn't those be distinctly different?
Let's see. Actually, yes. And one of the things that Marshall and Barry showed, almost as a corollary to their original paper, was that even if you knew what the mountain and valley assignments were, just finding the different orders was itself another NP-complete problem. So that, too, was hard. But in many cases, when we design an origami figure, we learn enough additional information that we can find the layer ordering. Crease assignment, which is good, because that enables us to fold great things. These rule, yes.
The other properties you mentioned, I could verify locally, like two colors, or
yep.
or M minus equal to alternate angle. I don't really understand the satisfying layer order property. Is that because it's not local? I mean, how does one verify when looking at a bunch of pieces on a piece of paper?
You've hit the nail on the head. The reason it becomes so hard is finding a valid crease assignment is inherently non-local. And the simplest example of that is, let's say I have a long strip of paper, and I've got two folds here, let's say about the third points, so that the ends fold in. These two bits interact with one another. One has to be above the other. So what happens over here can be affected by what happens over here, just by those two folds in the middle. So it's inherently non-local, and that's what makes it computationally intractable. And that also points us into the direction of a strategy for finding foldable crease patterns, is if we can find a way to keep everything relatively local, then we can solve the patterns. And that's what happens. So there is a hierarchy of progression that happens in origami that starts very abstractly. We start with these rules of flat foldability, which is pure math. But from those rules, we can create matching rules for splicing together pieces of crease patterns. And so that gives us an application of those rules. And with that application, we can create objects of beauty. We can create artwork. But the neat thing is that we can also use those to create functional objects and even make money. So how do we do that? Let me show you some examples. I'm going to start in the topic of textures. This is a texture. It's a very simple crease pattern. A bunch of vertical folds, zigzag, it's a pleat, and then I make the same folds horizontally. And if you fold it pleated vertically, pleated horizontally, what do you get? You get a smaller square, but now it's a little grid of squares. And if you kind of tip it to one side, it becomes a grid of diamonds. And you look at that and say, what does that remind me of? Well, it kind of looks like scales, but all by itself, it is boring. But what I can now do is I can take this folding pattern, a repetitive pattern, and I can use those rules to splice such a repetitive pattern into an origami pattern for an otherwise fairly simple shape. This is a crease pattern. This is exactly what you get from here. With a few more folds, you can shape it and get a kind of a nice-looking little fish. But by combining that periodic pattern with this crease pattern, according to those rules, you can create something of unusual beauty. And so this, too, is origami. One uncut square has about 400 scales, still folding, no cuts. This takes about 8 hours to fold. And if you don't have 8 hours, but you still want to apply patterns, well, you can apply it at a smaller scale and just use it to create the shell of this turtle and little details like the toes on the feet. So you can apply patterns at a small scale. And if you're feeling really ambitious, then this rattlesnake has about 1,000 scales.
How big is the original sheet in this case?
So difference. Most of these, the sheet's about 18 inch square, and in this case, it was about an 18 inch square, and the finished piece is about 12, 13 inches long. They're pretty efficient. This has 1,000 scales, and I swore I'd never do another snake with 1,000 scales, and I stuck to that. So this one has 1,500. So we can create textures and incorporate them in models. We can create textures and patterns on demand. And that's an, yeah?
When you're designing something, do you come up with what you want to do as an artistic object first and then try and develop a crease pattern?
Very definitely.
And how often do you design something where you don't get a crease pattern, modify the design, modify, is it an iterative process?
There's usually an iterative process in the kind of the fine-tuning, artistic fine-tuning. I'll fold something, and it'll come out, and then I'll say, you know, the legs ought to be a little shorter for artistic. So I'm going to go back and tweak the crease pattern to shorten these parts or to shift paper from here into there. So there's usually some iteration. But sometimes there's not time for iteration. I had a commission in which I had a week from commission to delivery, and I knew that folding it was going to take about 2 days. And I really was only going to have one shot at folding it, so it took about 2 to 3 days of designing it all ahead of time. and the design looked like this. So that's a complete design. Mountains and valleys. Valleys are dashed. Mountains are black. But that's the whole pattern. And here's what it looked like coming together over those 2 days. So we start with a square. That's a meter stick, so that's about a 28-inch square. And the first thing to do is to transfer the crease pattern onto the paper, which I can do by various ways, but in this case, I measure and mark. So drew very lightly on one side line, all the lines of the crease pattern, and then you start to fold. So first crease all the folds, and then start trying to put them together. And people often ask, what order do you do the folds? But in many cases, there is no order. You just have to kind of make them all happen at once. And that's what's happening here. Put a bunch of the creases in, and more. Finally, some of the fine-tuning, and there's the result. 50 stars and 13 stripes. Now, patterns are not the place where Matt had the biggest impact on origami, although it certainly has had some impact. But the biggest impact happened in representational design, things that look like origami that looks like other things. And we can express the origami design problem in a very simple equation. We start with an idea, we combine it with a square, we get an origami version of the subject. Simple, that's it. But as you know, mathematicians do these things to you. What matters is what do you mean by the symbol? That's where all the information is. What's really going on here? And you can also ask the question, is it possible to be that specific? I mean, this is not just a bug. This is a beetle. In fact, it's a specific type of beetle. It's a stag beetle. Stag beetle has jaws with 3 points on the jaws, and it's got an antenna, and it's got 6 legs, and a head, a thorax, and an abdomen. And, you know, can you be that specific about what you want and get it? And, yeah, you can. So how do we do it? Well, let me take that equation, and let me break it down into steps. And I'm going to start at the end. Start with what I want. I want to end up with a model of the folded shape. And what comes before that? Well, I need a shape that's got paper in the right place for all the parts. So I need a flap for a leg, and a flap for the jaw, and a flap for the antenna. So I need a bunch of flaps connected together. And I'll call that thing a base. Now, how would I describe that base? You know, I need the number of flaps, the lengths, how they're connected, and the simplest way of describing it is a stick figure, which we'll call a tree. And that stick figure ultimately comes from the subject. Now, let's go forward. Going from the subject to the stick figure, that's really easy. Every kid can draw a stick figure in shape. So that's an easy step for a person. And going from the base to the model, well, that's maybe not quite as easy, but I think you might grant me that if I handed you this, you could take the antenna flap and squunch it down narrow and make it look like an antenna, and take the leg flap and put a zigzag fold and make it look like a leg. So if I had the base, I could get to the model. That's pretty easy for a person. But going from the stick figure, the tree, to the base, that's the hard part for a person. But that is the step that math gets us over. So we want to go from a stick figure to a base. How do we do it? We have a base that's a collection of flaps, and a stick figure that's a collection of sticks. How do you make a collection of flaps that resembles a given stick figure? Well, that's a tough problem. So let's start really simple. Instead of figuring out how to make an arbitrary collection of flaps, let's just figure out how to make one flap. One flap. I hand you a sheet of paper and say, fold me a flap. Well, you probably do something about like this. You take the paper, say, I got to make it narrow because I want it long and skinny. So I'll fold it in half, and I fold it in half until it's long and narrow. And then if this part is my flap, I'll fold a little boundary here. And I'll say, okay, everything above the boundary is my flap. And everything below is leftover. Don't care. Now let's unfold it and look at the crease pattern. If I do that, you'll find here's the boundary of the flap. And so everything in here is flap. And everything outside is left over that I don't care about. So that's the paper that goes into a flap, that little quarter up. But what if I said make the flap skinnier? Well, that's easy. You'd fold the paper in half again before you made your boundary. And if you took a skinny flap and you unfolded it, you'd find instead of having a quarter of an octagon, you'd find the flap comes from a corner of a 16-sided one. And if I said take it to the limit, an infinitely skinny flap, you'd find that the paper comes from a quarter circle. So that's the minimum amount of paper needed to make a flap. And the radius of the circle is the length of the flap. So now you know how to make one flap. But that's not the only way to make a flap. I can make a flap instead of coming from the corner. What if it comes from the middle of the edge? Well, if you go through the same procedure, you'll find it comes from a half circle. And what if the flap comes from somewhere in the middle of the paper? Well, you go through the same thing and you find it comes from a full circle. So quarter circle, corner, edge, middle, quarter circle, half circle, full circle. Flaps always come from parts of a circle. Actually, they always come from a full circle. Because I can say, well, this is a full circle, it just happens to overlap the corner. And this is a full circle, it's just centered on the edge, and this is a full circle. So we unify the idea. No matter how we make a flap, it requires a circular region of paper. So now we beat the topic of one flap to death. But now we can turn to the next problem. What if I want to make not just one flap, make a bunch of flaps? What do I need? Well, what I need is a bunch of circles. And this was a revelation in the world of origami in the 1990s, that if I wanted to make a shape like a spider, eight legs, and then it was going to come from a base that had eight flaps, every one of those flaps took up a circular region of paper. And so I could find the arrangement of paper that gave me the flaps by finding an arrangement of eight circles that overlapped a square. Now, you might notice these circles don't overlap. Why is that? Is that a hard and fast rule? Well, think about it. What if they did overlap? What would that say about the paper in the overlap? It says that that paper has to be in two different flaps, two different places. So the simple rule for origami design was just you take a circle for every flap, you pack them, and you don't let them overlap. And that told how the paper had to be allocated. Turned out further that between the centers of any touching circles, there were always fold lines. And we eventually figured out why that is. But that doesn't give us all the folds we need for the base. So there had to be more to the problem. How do we fill in those polygons with folds? Well, we found that if you have a stick figure and these polygons from the circle packing, every polygon was a little piece of the stick figure. And you could even cut them apart and imagine treating each polygon separately. Let's just find the folds in this polygon that folds into this three-legged stick figure. And let's just find the folds in this polygon that folds into a four-legged stick figure. So now we've divided and conquered. We've split up the problem into a bunch of little problems that are all pretty similar, because triangle, triangle, triangle. If we know how to deal with a triangle, we've got most of this crease pattern. So what are the creases that fill in these shapes, triangles and quads? Well, again, in the mid-1990s, we discovered crease patterns, and we called them molecules. Actually, my colleague, Toshiki Meguro, came up with that term. We found for triangles, the creases that go inside are simply the angle bisectors, and you can take this shape, fold it into a little three-legged triangle, and that gives a three-legged piece of the crease pattern. In quadrilaterals, there's two kinds of stick figures for quads, which have a couple different crease patterns that worked for all of those. And I eventually found a pattern that works, an algorithm that worked for any polygon and any stick figure, no matter how big, that lets you fold it into a shape that has flaps for every stick of the stick figure. And that led to a new way of designing origami, an almost mechanical way, where you start with your idea. You do a circle packing, and here's a circle packing now for that spider. You fill in each of the polygons with these molecule crease patterns, and you fold. And that pattern is guaranteed to satisfy all of those flat foldability rules, guaranteed to fold into this shape, which is the base. Now, that doesn't look like a spider, but it's got eight flaps for legs. It's got two flaps for pedipalps. So you can take this base and do shaping and turn it into the spider, exactly the thing that you set out to do. And this capability led to a new era in designing origami, the era of intelligent design. Because you could design exactly what you wanted and do it intelligently. So if you wanted to fold this shape, which is an old ancient statue, it's a bull, but it's got a man's head and wings and a beard. You'd never find that by accident. But you can choose what you want, design it, and then fold it. And people design incredibly complicated origami using nothing more than pencil and paper and drawing these circle arrangements. But it's such a mechanical process that it lets us think to the next level of the problem. What if you have more than a pencil and paper? What if you have a computer? Because this procedure can be encoded as a computer algorithm. Now, you need a little different description of it if you want to do it on a computer. You can't talk about hacking circles and drawing lines. It needs to be a bit more formal, but one can formalize that problem. And the formal version, the algebraic version, looks like this. It's a problem called a non-convex nonlinear constrained optimization, and it's this system of equations, and I'm not even going to talk about the equations because equations are boring. But what's important is that this problem is a problem that's been solved by computer scientists. So we can rely on their solutions. We can apply their algorithms and solutions to solve this set of equations, and therefore to design origami using a computer. So I wrote a computer program called TreeMaker that does exactly this. You draw a stick figure, and this is an example from TreeMaker. It's a particular type of animal. It's got back legs and front legs and neck and head and ears and antlers, four tines on each antler, and a very specific branching pattern for the antlers. This is a deer. And it's not just any kind of deer. From the branching patterns, we can say it's an eastern white-tailed deer. And plug that into TreeMaker. That turns into about 200 equations, but in computational terms, that's trivial to solve. And TreeMaker duly spits out a crease pattern. And that's the crease pattern for the deer. You see it, right? Well, let me point some things out. Here's a circle. That's a front leg. That's a front leg. That's a tail. That's a back leg. That's a back leg. That's a nose. These things out here, those are ears. And all this stuff up there is antlers. And if you fold that up, it gives you a base. And with a little bit more shaping of the base, you get an eastern white-tailed deer.
But you fit some lengths in additionally, didn't you?
I'm sorry?
I mean, that pattern that you saw.
Yes.
I could distort that and still obey the rules by changing various lengths, which presumably would make the horns a bit longer and the antlers a bit longer.
Yes, that's exactly
right. At what stage did you feed in that, what you didn't tell us?
So I plugged in very specific lengths, which in fact I did by taking measurements of a photograph of a deer. But if you plug in different lengths or different connections, you'll get a different crease pattern, and you can make a different deer. So this is a mule deer. It's not just different lengths, but it's a different branching pattern, because mule deers branch separately. Or you can make an elk, which has much longer horns, and yet another branching pattern. And if you come from Canada, then you can make a moose. So this capability, this level of precision, led to some very interesting phenomena in the art world of origami. It led to, not bloodshed, but it led to wars. A thing called the bug wars. See, in the 1970s, people thought it was impossible to do an insect from a single uncut square. And you can even find old books that say that. But in the 1980s, people figured out that insects were actually possible. And in the 1990s, we could get down to the species level. And so there was. The bug wars were a battle of the species, of origami artists one-upping each other in the arena of insects. So someone would pull the tarantula. Oh, here's my tarantula. Spider, got eight legs, cut a pouch. What do you think of that? And the next guy goes, spider's okay, but look, my dragonfly has six legs and four wings. That's 10 flaps. Mine's more complicated. And it's got the back legs are longer than the middle legs, which are longer than the front legs, just like a real dragonfly. So I'm very, very precise. What do you say to that? Well, my samurai helmet beetle has horns, and it's got a branched horn on the thorax and a four-way branched horn on the head. And this type of beetle, these are popular in Japan, and people keep them as pets. And so, you know, I've got a beetle, so it's got horns, and yours, neither your dragonfly nor your spider have horns. And so it's got two long horns. Next guy go, yeah, but my Eupatorus has five horns. Four on the thorax, one on the nose, and its color change. The back side of the paper comes out brown on the wings right the way it's supposed to. And people would literally pour through entomology journals to find things that have lots and lots of horns that were going to be a big challenge. And then someone say, well, my mantis, you know, it's got long, skinny legs and antenna, and you know, so how can you talk a praying mantis from a single uncut square? And there's really only one way, which is two praying mantises. This one's called a snap time. She is just about to bite the head off of him, but it's from a single square. And this is the crease pattern I showed early on that you asked about.
It. I recognize it.
And, yes. Of course, you would. And of course, we had to get out of mere insects, get into other arthropods, so you can to find more legs, more challenge. So you do a centipede. The centipede's got looks like about 20 legs, or something like that. You say, okay, well, then I need to do more legs. So this one's got about 30. You can do more than just legs. So this is the full tick. He's already eaten, but we can also push the limits in other directions and try to go for really small things. And similarly, this leaf hopper is also.
How does he hold something so teeny?
With tweezers and the eyes of a 25-year-old. Or reading glasses nowadays. One of the interesting things... Yeah, go ahead.
With the existence, though, of the folding program, does that reduce the design burden significantly?
The program doesn't particularly reduce the design burden relative to pencil and paper. Most people... myself included, still use pencil and paper to do our complex designs because it allows us to incorporate ideas that aren't yet written into the program. But certainly, without those mathematical ideas, none of this would be remotely possible.
What is the math relevant to when you use the opposite side of the paper for the contrasting color? Because, the circle's just on one side of the paper. Everything you've talked about has been one side of the paper.
Yep. So to use the two sides of the paper to get the color change field, what's the math that's involved? And the answer is there's very little written down, and there are a lot of open problems relating to color changing. It's been proven that any two-color pattern is possible, but only by using very, very inefficient folding algorithms. There's a famous problem in origami circles, which is to fold the n-by-n checkerboard, black and white, with the two sides coming out. And for a long time, there was a conjecture that the maximum size of the checkerboard relative to the size of the square was a relationship based on the perimeter of the square, thinking that the idea was somehow the perimeter, the square, was the boundary between black and white and had to snake all the way around. But that's been overturned in the limit of very, very large checkerboards. So no one actually knows what the upper limit is. So the answer is there is math, we don't know, and that's a great open problem for the budding PhD student. But even before we solve it, we can apply rules of thumb and heuristics and create pieces like the beetle and some more of these insects. And one of the neat things that's come about is that the crease patterns themselves turn out to be very beautiful. So this is a flying Katie did. It was a challenge from a friend, a brilliant folder at MIT named Brian Chan. And so that's a crease pattern for the Katie did. And they're beautiful patterns all on their own.
Can you show us from the previous slide to this one, where you seem to have one appendage or something sticking out, then it kind of bends several times along the way. Can you show us how those bends are shown in this? Like, look at its rear legs, for example. It's got these little bumps and bends. Can you show us where that appears in the crease pattern?
Yes. So the bumps and bends don't appear. The crease pattern is always the base. So if you fold the crease pattern, for example, you would get a shape where the legs are absolutely straight, and also the legs are a uniform width. And similarly, you'd get a shape where the wing is a uniform width, where the antenna is the same width and straight. So the crease patterns only give you that base. the kind of geometric shape of the flaps in the right place. There is still a level of sculpting that happens that is not described by the math, that really is the artist's intuition. And in some cases, for things that are curved, like the curvature of the back, that's not even a fold, it's kind of a distributed fold. How would you even convey that?
So two different artists using the same base could come out with slightly different, because of the artistic final step?
Yep, in fact, they could. They are often distinctly different. Okay. So at one level, most people, when they fold my if they try to fold my designs, they don't fold it the way I would. I mean, in my view, I say it's not as good, but it's certainly different. I mean, it's not the way I would do it. But there, I had the experience of a Japanese folder once who would fold my designs stunningly, but different. I mean, I could look at his, and I couldn't pin my finger on anything because it was just subtle shaping, but it was unmistakably his and not mine in the way he treated it. So there is this artistic aspect of it.
Could that artistic aspect one day be translated in some mathematical language, or does it remain something that is undefinable and just very personal?
It is very personal. I think it's anything is, in principle, describable by mathematics, but it might be so complex and or computationally intractable to do that description. I think it's unlikely that it will ever happen for that reason.
It sounds like for a given base, you could get infinitely many artistic renderings.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, Yoshizawa, when asked how many figures had he folded, how many designs did he have, he would say 10,000 or 20,000. And it wasn't that he had 20,000 truly different bases, but he viewed every time he folded it, he'd shape it differently, he'd give it different personality, and in his mind, it was a different figure. And so I'll say, even for something like one of these, these are so complex that if I fold it twice, it'll look different from one to the next. I can't make it identically even if I try, because it's so near the limits of what's physically foldable. This is a commission, and that's its crease patterns. Which I like the beauty of the patterns themselves. So we can do more than just insects. Design was good for bug wars, but it's also good for just beautiful representational origami. So this is a grizzly bear, but I can use those techniques to put toes on its feet and teeth in the jaws and give it a little personality. Or I can put eyes and toes on a frog, again, to give it a little character. We can do human shapes. This is a man playing guitar. We can also do more than one figure from a single sheet. The man and the guitar are from a single sheet of paper. And in this case, the man and his bass are from a single sheet of paper. So a person and an instrument. And you say, well, guitar and an instrument are not very challenging instruments. Can you do that with a more challenging instrument? So, what this has allowed is a creation of origami on demand, because we can create almost anything. And this has led to applications of origami in graphic arts, commercials, and advertisements. And I want to show an example, which is a commercial I worked on a couple years ago. And I'll click over to it in just a second. Before it starts, I'll tell you that everything you see in this, except the car, is folded paper. So, as you probably guessed, there was some computer magic to make things move, but all the things that move started as a folded origami model. And just as one example, this is a still showing the houses that you saw at the end as we're putting things up gives you a sense of the scale. And I mentioned my partner for this project, Linda Tomoko Mihara, a folder from San Francisco. Now, I said I wrote that computer program, and it's available, and it's free. The algorithms are in a computational geometry paper in lay terms in a book I wrote back in 2003, but you can download the program. It runs on Mac and Linux and the other operating system. and the source code's available. It's GPL, so if anyone wants to build and expand, you're welcome to it. So feel free to give it a try. TreeMaker was the first origami design software, but it was rapidly joined by other origami programs, and this is a listing of a couple of them that do things. TreeMaker finds stick figure-like shapes. Origamizer does this for arbitrary surfaces. You can find the step-by-step instructions with my program reference finder. There's a whole bunch of these, and I want to just show some of the amazing things that people applying computational thinking and math are now accomplishing. Origamizer is a program by Tomohiro Tachi, just came out about 3 years ago, and he can take any 3D computer shape, this is a famous shape used in rendering called the Utah teapot, and unfold it, find a crease pattern that folds back into that shape. So this is not computer rendering, this is a photograph of the result of folding this computed crease pattern by Tachi. British artist and geneticist Alex Bateman wrote a program called TESS that finds tessellations, periodic, repeatable patterns that are simply beautiful examples of folding, similar to stained glass windows or Moorish tilings. This is a design from the TESS program, and these are some folded examples of these tilings. And that leads to a new area, the area of geometric origami. Not all origami is representational. It doesn't all look like something. Geometric origami includes patterns, flat tessellations, 3D shapes, curved shapes, and many more things. I want to show some examples. These are a couple of these tessellation patterns. They're flat. It starts flat, it remains flat, but the beauty lies in the pattern of the folded edges. And as a genre, this goes back quite a ways and exists outside the Japanese world of origami. This computer scientist named Ron Resch pioneered this field, developing periodic patterns back in the 60s. This is an image from a patent that he filed, which is now expired, so we can all fold it. But he created many beautiful shapes, periodic domes, curved patterns, these sort of swirly things, just really gorgeous. One of his proteges, a fellow named David Huffman, professor at Santa Cruz, who is unknown in origami, but is famous in technology because he invented a thing called Huffman codes, which are used in all signal processing nowadays. But he invented origami techniques and the mathematics. So he created these faceted forms and beautiful curved forms like this. And he showed how you can compute the folding pattern for a flat shape that, when you fold it, forms into a specific three-dimensional shape. In this case, this pattern folds into a trefoil. This pattern folds into what's called a 4,1 toroidal knot. And similar techniques gave these swirly things. This is another of Huffman's designs that has this neat, interesting property that if you pull two sides of it, the whole thing opens up in one smooth motion. And that's beautiful, but it's also practical. And that leads to the last thing. Motions like that have applications in the real world. And origami has turned out to have applications in space, medicine, automotive, consumer electronics, and many other places. And it's a real application of the pattern moves directly from origami into a technical field. This is a folded pattern called Miura Ori, studied by Japanese professor Koryo Miura. And he realized this pattern folds in a single smooth motion, which is what you want for something that has to unfold in space. And so this pattern he designed into a solar array that flew on a Japanese satellite in 1995. We fold things in space. This is a telescope, James Webb Space Telescope. It's going to go up in a couple of years. And it has two folds in it. The telescope has two vertical folds so that the sides fold in like that. Now, why do you want to do that? Well, this is this big 4-meter-ish telescope, It's got to get the space in a smaller rocket. Mm-hmm. And so you need to collapse it down. You need to make it small so that it all fits into the rocket. It's got to be small for the journey, but then large and flat at the destination. Two folds is not a tough problem. James Webb Space Telescope designers don't need an origami artist to tell them how to put two folds into their telescope. But a larger telescope did require a more complicated problem. This was a concept at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. The idea is you put this telescope in geostationary orbit, and your primary lens is 100 meters in diameter. So that's the size of a football field. And this thing is, the eyepiece is going to be 1 or 2 kilometers away in a higher orbit. So you're going to put this giant lens up in space. How do you get it? It's a Fresnel lens. It's a thin sheet of glass with holographic grooves on the surface. But the only way we have to get things into space is a rocket, 3 or 4 meters in diameter. So you have to make this big flat sheet smaller in a very controlled way. A controlled flattening pattern calls for folding, and so therefore they realized they needed to find a folding pattern. Well, how could you fold a big round disk? Well, this is the obvious one. You cut it up into pie slices, you put hinges between the slices, and then you can fold it over and over, and you can make it smaller and smaller in this way. But it's still going to be, in full size, half the length this way. This is a much smaller replica, you can see, because there's a dollar bill. So you need a more complicated folding pattern. Well, the Livermore engineers, being good engineers, said, let's see if someone out there, somewhere out there, there are solutions we can take advantage of, not reinvent the wheel. So they looked through the literature, they found some of my papers, I got involved with them, and we started designing folding patterns. And these are some of the patterns we developed. This spirally pattern shown here, and that's the flat version, is very similar to that thing of Dr. Hoffman's that opens and closes as it turns. But we eventually settled on this pattern, which we call the umbrella because it looks kind of like the collapsible umbrella. If you look at this ring and follow this series of deformations, this ring folds down into a cylinder. And the center could be the bottom of the cylinder. And if you add more rings, they all fold the same way and just keep adding layers to the cylinder. So you could scale this ring pattern arbitrarily. Mm-hmm. Another nice feature is it uses very simple shapes, half triangles, full triangles, and rectangles. And so the whole pattern can be made from just a small number of blanks, and that's more cost effective. So they use that pattern for the first design. These are some test structures, not glass, but you can see that the fold lines here, we even use dashed lines. Those are the hinges, and this little gantry lifts parts up to test the folding technology. And it works, so they use that pattern for the first generation prototype, which was a 5-meter telescope. It's not 100 meters yet, but 5 meters is still pretty big. That's twice the size of the Hubble Space Telescope. And this is a fully working lens on its test range at Livermore. How do you test a lens that has a half kilometer focal length? Well, you hold the lens sideways, and you shine the light horizontally. So you go out here, and you set your laser. You go out there, and you set your detector. You can measure. And this met all of its design requirements. Folding shows up in solar sails, big flat things that you want to get into space in a small bundle. And this is a photograph of a solar sail on a Japanese mission that unfolded in 2004. As it deployed, you can see the fold lines. It was folded up and then unfolds to get larger. The most surprising to me application of origami, as I read about last year, Japanese Aerospace Agency approved an experiment to fly paper airplanes from space. And it sounds crazy. This is a photograph of one of their planes in testing. It sounds crazy. You'd think, how could something like that get into space? But this little guy here has already gone at Mach 7 and 400 degrees C. Pretty secure.
Why did it burn up? Why did it burn up?
No oxygen. Origami has also been used in optics. Back in the late 60s, John Meyer, researcher at Hughes, wrote an article showing that you could use the origami fold called a reverse fold to simulate optical systems, that the angular relationships of the fold exactly matched optics. And that was a curiosity, but in my prior life as a laser physicist, one of my engineers, Mats Hogberg, came up with this clever idea that if you took a rectangular laser cavity for a semiconductor laser and put two folds into it so that the light bounced around between the folds. Mm-hmm. The folds actually had the property that it cleaned up the laser beam, and you got a more powerful, brighter beam. And these types of lasers are used in, well, in color generation, in machining. And here we've got a whole bank of these angled lasers, and they're slicing holes in a razor blade, so you could use them for machining. This whole set of lasers here is just about the size of the last joint of your finger. It's the same type of laser, in fact, that's used in pointers like this. Biologists have turned to origami. There's groups studying the thermodynamics of cell membranes, which doesn't sound very much like origami. But if you look, take a cell membrane, this is a computer rendering, and you start zooming in and zooming in, you find that what this membrane actually is a grid of atoms. It's a sheet that's made up of a grid of atoms. And how does that membrane move? It bends only along the atomic bonds. So figuring out the way this bends is equivalent to figuring out how a triangular grid sheet folds. And why is that relevant? The most important concept in thermodynamics is this thing called entropy. The entropy comes from the number of different ways of folding the surface. So the thermodynamic problem is really a folding problem. How many different ways per unit area can you fold a triangular grid? And if you know that answer, that tells you what you need to know to study the thermodynamics of cell membranes. So there are people who look at the different ways of folding a triangular grid. I will point out, this is just one of them. This is a mask by Joel Cooper, brilliant artist in Kansas. Now, other things in biology fold, like proteins. Proteins are represented as these 1D chains, but in many cases, because of the way they interact, they can be better represented by strips of paper, and the way they move obeys laws as if these were actual strips of paper. And so wanting to know how a chain of atoms turns into a protein is solving, again, a folding problem, so in 1D strips. And this is the big question in biology. How does a protein chain fold up? The fundamental laws of folding apply whether you're folding a paper model of proteins or folding a real protein based on atoms. You can use the same fundamental laws, and people are indeed studying the mathematics of folding to apply to proteins. Now, we don't need to be microscopic to make a difference in medicine. This is an origami stent graft. It was developed by Zhang Yu at Oxford University. A stent is a little tube that holds open a blocked artery, and you want to make this tube small, thread it up through a blood vessel, and then have it open up, and it holds the blocked artery open. And Kaori Kurabayashi recognized that if she took a cylindrical pattern and she patterned it with an origami crease pattern, shown here, that pattern would allow it to collapse into that small bundle. And this is in development. I just read that human testing will start in 2012. For some larger things, this is a heart implant developed by Pericor Medical. It's for congestive heart failure. They inject what amounts to a plastic bag that wraps around the heart and cradles it. Goes in through between the ribs, and so this large plastic bag gets folded down into this little injection tube. The most surprising application has come in automotive. Airbag designers they've got a little challenge ahead of them. Their bags need to work, whether the car's going fast or slow. Big person far from the steering wheel, little person right up next to the steering wheel. It's got to work under a lot of different conditions. How do you verify that when you design an airbag? You do one of two things. You either crash a lot of cars under different conditions, or you do simulation. Of course, they prefer to do simulation. But they had a problem. The simulation needs to start from a flat airbag. But the designers design an expanded airbag, because it's got to be this wide and that long and fit in this space. So they needed to know, how do you flatten it in simulation? And that was an unknown problem. But it turns out, the algorithms for designing origami solved that problem. In fact, the universal molecule algorithm, the algorithm for filling in the creases in those insects, gives you the creases you need to flatten an airbag. And so armed with that algorithm from origami, airbag designers could flatten. flatten their airbag in simulation, carry out the simulation in plates, stands out, and hopefully it has done its job. Now, a lot of these examples that I've talked about, if you will pardon a slight bit of advertisement, are going to show up in a new book. It's coming out in the fall, called Origami Forward, because it's the proceedings of a fourth conference on origami in math, science, and education. And you can find out about that at my website, and that there is a fifth origami conference that's going to happen in 2010 in Singapore. But I don't want to stop on that point. I want to stop on a question. Where did that come from? Where did that heart stent come from? Well, it came from the water bomb, the blow-up balloon, the thing I showed very first. That's the crease pattern that solved the heart stent. What about the airbag flattening algorithm? Where did that come from? That came from the design of insects, people figuring out how to do more advanced folded shapes. So no one thought of those applications at the time. But this always happens in math, sciences, and even in the arts. The problems you solve for their aesthetic value often turn out down the road to have a real practical application. And in the case of origami, some of those problems might even save a life. Thanks for your attention.